Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The Red Sox of the 1970s were the team of near misses and lost chances, the team that could not win. That suited author Nicholas Davidoff just fine, as he writes in his new memoir, "I had come to believe that nothing worthwhile comes without great suffering." So it was with his favorite baseball team, and so it was with his childhood. Up next on Point, "The Crowd Sounds Happy," Nicholas Davidoff on life lessons from the diamond and beyond. You can join our conversation. Is it only a game, or is baseball an allegory for wins and losses of everyday life? Why is it that we root for the underdog on the playing field, but not always in life? Joining me now from New York City is author Nicholas Davidoff. His new book, a memoir, is called "The Crowd Sounds Happy: Love, Madness, and Baseball." You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Nicholas Davidoff, welcome to On Point.
It's nice to be here.
Thank you for being here. To understand your love of and connection to baseball, you really need to understand your early life. I wondered if you'd start here by just describing a bit of your childhood.
Sure. I grew up, I'd say, in a slightly unconventional way, but I suppose that everybody feels that way. I was born in Washington. I was born in New York City, and then quickly we moved to Washington, D.C. And when I was 3 years old, my father began to have visions of things that weren't actually there. He thought that animals in the backyard were talking to him and giving him instructions on how to behave, and he became increasingly violent. And it soon became clear that this wasn't a safe place to bring up children. So I was 3 years old, and my younger sister Sally was one, and my mother had to leave, and she took us from Washington, D.C. to New Haven, Connecticut, where I grew up. And, you know, it was just the three of us for the rest of my childhood. And I grew up in a fairly small apartment with only my mother, who was, you know, very soon divorced. And my father left Washington, D.C. eventually and came to New York. And so, we didn't have a lot of money because my father really couldn't work and never really sent very much. And my mother worked, but of course she was a school teacher. And, you know, it was in some ways a straitened childhood. But in other ways, I would say, first of all, cry no tears for me. I think in many ways that I had a wonderful and vivid childhood. I had an incredibly supportive and interesting mother and, you know, a wonderful sister. And I think it's so much about life is what you make of it. And in my childhood anyway, there were so many things that were sort of presented to me to make things of, from books to baseball.
Mm-hmm. You put an optimistic spin on it, but there was great difficulty, and especially with your father, who was a brilliant man, valedictorian of his class in high school, a National Honor Society member, Harvard, Yale, the list goes on. At what point did you realize that he was mentally ill?
Well, yeah, I'd say that the story of my father's life is a story of tremendous tragedy. I mean, my father was the child of American immigrant, and he grew up on Long Island, and he played high school football with the NFL Hall of Famer Jimmy Brown, and he was a star. You know, he went to Harvard. He was a star lacrosse player and a wonderful student at Harvard. He had a gorgeous tenor singing voice. He was a French horn player. He was admitted to Harvard Law School, and his life just seemed to be one of those golden American lives. But even when he was at college, he was already truly struggling. He had a breakdown that is reminiscent of sort of the breakdowns that Faulkner describes, you know, where the boy who was sort of the great golden hope of the family, just things happen to him and he completely falls apart. And that happened to my father. And then he recovered and he did go to law school. But then, you know, he had a second breakdown and he recovered and he then went to Yale Law School. But all his life was increasingly darkened by this terrible, terrible disease. And how much did I know about it? I knew that my father wasn't like other men that I knew, but he was my only father. And, you know, that in my childhood anyway, it was a time still in American history when people didn't talk about many of the things which are discussed now with sort of great ease and familiarity. And mental illness was one, and certainly divorce was another. So that I grew up in a family where I would say this was a common condition that it just wasn't spoken of. It was just known that my father was somebody who you had to be very, very careful around whenever you saw him. And certainly as a little boy, I was aware that he was just strange, strange in the sense that I never knew who he was going to be from visit to visit. And certainly there were, you know, traumatic episodes when he was really sick, when he would do things that were terrifying. But on the day-to-day, I think part of his condition meant that what was perhaps even more troubling for me is that moment to moment, I never knew who I was dealing with. And so that from the time I was very small, there was kind of a way that I felt responsible for the atmosphere. I had to sort of take care and be in control and be watchful. And usually that's a role that you would, you know, assume a parent to take. But my father wasn't capable of protecting anybody. It was quite the opposite. So, but I guess just quickly to answer your question, I didn't know through most of my childhood. I had no idea what was wrong. I just knew that something was wrong.
You talk a lot in your book, you write a lot about childhood longings from fatherhood, from the father that you had but not really. Big things like that to small things like bazooka gum, among other things. Things that you didn't have because you were struggling and your mom, as hard as she worked, couldn't provide a lot of things. I wonder if you'd read a little bit from the book about some of that.
Sure. I guess what I would say about it is a couple of things. That when you have a great but sort of unacknowledged longing as a child, often those longings are expressed in much smaller ways. So I think that I, as a child, had all these things that I sort of yearned for. But if I, you know, because I really didn't want to express the great impossible thing, which was that my dad would feel better, you know. So I was a kid who wanted little things, maybe a little more ardently than other people. And when I was 5 years old, I was always a pretty good kid. If you have a father in Washington, he was soon to move to New York. He was still in Washington at the time, who's really out of control. One of the things you really want is control. But of course, like any other kid, you also want to, you know, have the license for transgression. So this is my first transgression. In our strict household, there never really were many rules. My mother's expectations flowed so logically from her own comportment that they were easy enough to understand without the aid of codes, injunctions, or prohibitions. Perhaps it was that in Washington everything had been so out of control that now everyone was grateful for routine. But whatever the cause, Sally and I didn't have to be told twice never to begin eating before everyone else was served. In the morning, as soon as we were tall enough, we made our beds. Then somebody gave me a penny to buy a piece of bazooka bubblegum, and that first taste was like offering a dog chopped sirloin. I would do anything for more. The ensuing bubblegum ban was grounded in a fierce jurisprudence that led my mother to inveigh in screeds meant not only to stigmatize but abominate. Bubblegum was, she lectured, the bottomless perdition, a silent fiend scoring holes into your teeth, even as it was capable of far worse, taking incisors and bicuspids within its terrible sticky grasp and yanking them right out. You don't want to end up with real dental problems, Nikki, she warned. Son, they'll plague you for life. The bubbles themselves were offensive to my mother. It looked so vulgar, that bulbous thing hanging out of your mouth, as was the coloring, that lewd pink. Her contention that there was something cheap about bubblegum, she buttressed with expressions of contempt for its physical nature. You are aware you're chomping on plastic, an abstract character. It's a gadget food, Nikki. When I went through a period of swallowing the gum, she was aghast. You can't digest that. And her disapproval broadened. To her, it was no less than the embodiment of all that was wrong with the country in the 1960s and early 1970s. We were a nation on the bubble, artificially sweet. Her disapproval did no good. I was so mad for the stuff that I thought all the time about how to get some. When I came into a dollar, I committed my first conscious transgression, sneaking down to Cumberland Farms to invest all of it on 100 penny pieces of bazooka. You got a larger chunk of gum for your penny then, and the brown bag I brought it all home in would have held both my shoes. After I ate a dozen pieces, I hid the rest in the backyard sandbox. I remember putting the brown bag in there and closing the hinged green top as I thought about all the days and weeks I would now be in supply. Minutes later, I was back for a fresh piece, then 5 pieces. They were all gone by nightfall because the flavor didn't last.
Your writing is so mesmerizing. It just draws you in, this book. With all of that as a backdrop, Nicholas Davidoff, tell us how then you discovered baseball.
I first discovered baseball when at age, I remember exactly the day, I was 6 years old, and my mother had one sister. Her name was Susie, and she lived in Westchester County, in the suburbs of New York City. And we would go frequently to see my aunt, and it was always a great occasion to go see my aunt because she was the sensual member of the family. My mother was a very pretty, very intelligent, extremely capable woman, but my mother had a tremendous amount, both with my father and also just the burden of bringing up two kids and holding a job and all the other pressures. And so there was something different about going to see my aunt, whose nature was just, I don't know how to put it except to say that she was an extremely sensual person. She was a very, very voluptuous woman. She was interested in color. She was interested in smell. She liked cooking, and she liked singing and sound and noise. And she's just a very, very fertile, sensual person. And whenever we'd come to visit, she'd be out there on the porch greeting us, giving us all big hugs and, calling out to us and so forth. But this time when we arrived, there was nobody there. And I went onto the porch, and I looked through the window, and she and my cousin and my uncle were sitting on a couch staring at a television. And when I came inside and tried to say hello, they told me to be quiet. And they were watching on the screen what turned out to be baseball players. And my aunt was incredibly excited. And as I watched, I was really watching my aunt because I was the sort of kid, you paid attention to what other people do. And I was always trying to be sort of a normal and healthy kid for pretty obvious reasons if you had a dad like mine, even then when you're really little. And so when I noticed what my aunt liked so much, I wanted to like it too.
And that was the beginning.
That was the beginning. It was baseball, and I loved it.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We are talking about love, madness, and baseball this hour with the author Nicholas Davidoff. His new book is The Crowd Sounds Happy. So you told us the story, Nicholas, before the break of seeing your Aunt Susie watching that World Series game, and that was your sort of first exposure to baseball. You started out as a Mets fan, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, she was watching the 1969 World Series, and in particular, she was watching the handsome, wonderful pitcher Tom Seaver lead the Mets to their surprising World Series victory, and she loved it, and so I loved it because she did.
And so how and why did you turn to the Red Sox?
I was a Mets fan for a few years, and it was just, baseball was such an exciting thing. It was this other world, with these heroic men who were, it was interesting, and it was parallel to life, and it was every day there was a baseball game, and there were, it was a game that very quickly I liked to play too, and then here were the people who were the best at it, and they were heroic masculine characters, and they were healthy, and they were strong, and they were vivid, and it was just incredibly exciting for me. I guess it was like tin soldiers for other kids. This was just how I imagined daily life with this alongside it. And, but as my father, the older I got, as a boy, my father became sicker and sicker. And I didn't know he was sicker. I just knew that he was a way that I really couldn't stand to be around. And this was not a conscious thing. But at a certain point, being a fan of the New York Mets, where, he was a man who lived in New York City, became increasingly difficult for me. And my beloved grandfather, whose name was Alexander Gershenkron, he was a Harvard economist. He had, when I was a little boy, I also used to go visit him in the summers, and we'd listen to Red Sox games on his transistor radio. Mm. And he talked about the Red Sox as sort of nine-inning fairy tales, and they were all these heroic figures, these sort of knights who were the representatives of New England, And they were going out to fight New York, among other places. And at a certain point, I just, I couldn't give up my father, but I think there must have, this wasn't conscious, of course, but there was something symbolic about just sort of quietly switching my allegiances to Boston. Mm.
Even as a kid, you recognized that loyalty and how it was shifting.
Yeah. I mean, loyalty is such a crucial thing if you want to be, an ethical person. And I was a little kid who, in the basic ways of little kids, I wanted to be good.
Right.
And I saw around me things that I didn't think were good. So then to give up something that wasn't good seemed confusing because you weren't being loyal, and you should be loyal to things, especially things that maybe couldn't help it. And that's the problem with mental illness. Mm-hmm. You know that at the root of it, people who have it can't help it. And so how do you think about people who do bad things, especially if they're your parent, but they're not really responsible because there's something, just in them that makes them do it?
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to some sound from a famous game, October 21st, 1975. The Boston Red Sox trailed the Cincinnati Reds 3-2 in the World Series. It was a 12th-inning home run in Game 6 of that series that tied things up for the Red Sox. Here's Dick Stockton with the call.
And the wind blowing out. We've had three homers tonight, all to right field or right or center field. Carbo's was to dead center. The other two to right. There's a ball. There it goes, a long drive. If it stays fair, home run.
Game 6 of the 1975 World Series became known as the Carlton Fisk game for the legendary Sox catcher who willed that ball to stay inside the foul line.
We will have a seventh game in this 1975 World Series. Carlton Fisk becomes the first player in the series to hit one over the wall into the net. Red Sox win it 7-6 in 12 innings. And Carlton Fisk had a lot of little boy in him right there, Joe.
The next night, the Red Sox led Game 7 of the World Series 3-0. They lost that game 4-3, dashing the hopes of Red Sox fans everywhere who hadn't seen a World Series win since, 1918? Do you remember that game, Nicholas Davidoff?
I do remember that game. I watched it with my cousin, and I just remember the incredible sorrow and disappointment that I suppose everyone felt. As I got older, though, there seemed to me, I guess, something appropriate about being a fan of a team which year after year seemed to find ever more dramatic or even melodramatic and histrionic ways of seeming about to win and then losing. They were sort of artists of defeat. And for me, my heroic team, you know, the team that I loved, there was something, I think, almost comforting about being the fan of a team that was filled with such shimmering promise that certifiably was something wonderful and yet always came up a little bit short. Because for me, again, this isn't conscious, but I think it certainly seemed that way. It was very comparable to how I felt about, you know, the man in my family. Mm-hmm.
Read from your book, would you, Nicholas, about listening to the Red Sox in your room on the radio at night. Take us there.
Sure. As a boy, I started listening on a transistor radio, but then I got it was a Radio Shack Chronomatic 9 radio, which I still have. And I had it in my room next to my bed. And my room was at the center of our apartment. My sister's room was through one door. The bathroom was through another door. And my mother slept in the living room through a third door. So I really didn't have that much privacy. And I would kind of lose myself in these baseball games. And I would listen on the Chronomatic 9 from the time I was, you know, this is probably from 12 years old right up through. So what I was listening to in my room were Boston Red Sox baseball games. I hadn't been able to get the Boston games on my old transistor, and to discover now that reception was possible on the Chronomatic 9 was joy. By game time, I would have spread my homework along my bed, distributing the books and papers lengthwise so that when I positioned myself on the floor, knees to the rug, chest pressed against the edge of the mattress, head bent over my books, to Sally and my mother passing behind me, it must have looked as though I was supplicating myself to physics and Lord Jim. The radio was to my left and on the night table, and as I worked, the team broadcaster Ned Martin said, "Welcome to Fenway Park in Boston," and right then a part of me zoomed down the I-91 highway entrance ramp and lifted out of New Haven. Martin and his commentating partner would discuss the game to come, building the anticipation until Martin cried, "Here come the Red Sox," and as he introduced the players, position by position, Jim Rice, left field, Fred Lynn, center field, it was like having the cast of characters read aloud to you from the beginning of a Russian novel. All quieted as the crowd rose to listen while an organist played the national anthem. And I stood too, put my hand to my heart, and with no flag in the room to gaze upon, instead stared fixedly at a red, white, and blue book spine on my shelf for the duration of the song. My mother began to come in and watch me standing there in still, patriotic tribute. At first, I wished she would just leave me alone, but over time, I began to like her observance of my observance. And when the door didn't open, I'd reach toward the radio and raise the volume to let her know she was missing the anthem.
What was it that was ignited in your mind, in your imagination, by those baseball games on the radio?
Well, I think, as I just said, one of the things certainly was that you could disappear into this other fascinating masculine world, which was just somewhere else from where I was. It was very different from New Haven. It was different from the possibility that my father was going to call up on the phone and start screaming at me. It was just also, I loved my mother and I loved my sister, but they were both women and I wanted to know what men did. And these were, in effect, the men in my house. You know, one of the wonderful things about radio, as opposed to watching baseball on television, is that the whole game is available to you. There are no limitations. The television camera can see only what the camera shows you. But with the radio, it's all there for you, and it's there for you to sort of see it as you want to. And I think that's one of the things that has made historically baseball such a popular game, that maybe 50,000 people are at a ballpark watching the same game, but everybody's seeing a different game. The game in your mind is a different game. And in my mind, the game was that here were these the broadcaster was Ned Martin, who was an incredibly erudite guy. I used to imagine that he sat in the lobby of hotels when the team was on the road reading Penguin Classics or something. You know, he was just very literary, and he spoke so beautifully, and he was so enthusiastic about the Red Sox. He made them, just as my grandfather did, into these heroes of fairy tales, you know, or myths or something. Mm-hmm. And so in this man's beautiful voice, he's describing the heroic actions of these great players. And so the men in my house, the men in my life, in many ways, were Ned Martin and these Boston Red Sox baseball players, and they could be whoever I wanted them to be.
And you say in the book the Red Sox were a lot like your father. They never seemed to win, but they always kept going.
Yeah, they did. That's one of the things that I so much admire about my father. It's much easier when you're an adult to feel this way. As a child, you know, your father's supposed to protect you, and mine was always scaring the hell out of me, so it's a little bit different. But as an adult, I come to recognize all the more, you know, things about what his life was like. I mean, my father had a horrible life. I mean, he was somebody of such great promise, and he was struck down by this just terrible, terrible disease. One of the most terrible things about mental illness, of course, is that nobody can see it. So that in many ways, you look like a normal, healthy person, and yet you're behaving in such unpredictable, aberrant ways, and you can't see it either. And to my father's credit, I think I have to say that throughout his life, no matter what happened to him, he was, you know, he'd be turned out of his house. He was sometimes homeless. He was in and out of mental institutions, but no matter what happened to him, he always said that it was going to get better and that he was going to make it and he was going to return to become what he had always seemed intended to be. And at the time, I would find that incredibly frustrating. Why wouldn't he admit the circumstances? But looking back, I just admire the courage and the integrity and the valor of somebody who suffered like that and just kept going and going and going. And, you know, it reminds me, you know, my father was a star player for the Harvard lacrosse team when he was a young man, still healthy. And he was never a particularly gifted natural athlete, but a story I know about him is that when the team would come in after practice and they'd all be taking showers, there'd always be one player missing, and that was my father. He'd be out on that darkening field running extra laps by himself, and that's really the way he lived his life.
Tell me a little bit more about your mother. In the book, she really comes across as the one sort of solid, constant influence in your life. By all accounts, a remarkable woman, daughter of a Harvard professor, a stoic in many ways, strong and principled and overwhelmed and vulnerable and all these things. You really think of her as the protagonist in this book, don't you?
I do, and I think of my mother as a truly heroic figure for many reasons. I think as a writer, I think of her as a heroic person first and foremost because she brought me up to love books, and many of the reasons that I wrote this book have to do with the books that I loved as a child. I loved, you know, coming-of-age stories always, like Great Expectations and David Copperfield and My Antonia and Tom Sawyer and To Kill a Mockingbird, and I could go on and on. But what seems, you know, to bind them all together is that these are novels of complicated people who are sort of coming into their own, being whoever they're going to be. And my mother loved those books, and that's one reason that I loved them. And one of the things that I love about them is they present characters in their full complexity. And my mother, as an English teacher, allowed me to write. You know, it's traditional that people write memoirs late in life, and I wrote mine when I was somewhat younger while my main character was still alive. And I think one of the things I so much admire about my mother, and it's so typical of her character, is that she allowed me to write about my childhood in full. And this is a nonfiction sort of version of those coming-of-age stories, and she is, in many ways, the central character, but it is in no way a panegyric. I mean, this is, if it's a Valentine to my mother, it is not without tremendous complexities, because you cannot live the life that my mother lived as a divorced single woman without very much money and all sorts of pressures on her without responding to those pressures with, you know, there's great stress and anxiety, and believe me, it wasn't always fun to be around her.
And so what did she think when she read the book?
you know, and certain, I guess I always say you should ask her, but what she always says to me is that she's proud of it and that she thinks it's the truth. It's both the factual truth, but it's also, you know, I didn't seek to write a book that was just my story. I sought to do in my own small way what those great books that I loved as a child did, which was to use my own childhood experience to write about an American boyhood, to write about, I would say, larger themes, you know, in the sort of the spirit of fiction, but in a very truly factual nonfiction way. And those themes are things like desire, you know, and how a childhood responds to his landscape and the uses of the imagination to overcome the sorrows of youth, and failure and shame and, you know, I don't know, compassion and love and just the great themes of literature. And so in my own small way, that's what I set out to do.
We have a caller who'd like to ask you a question, Nicholas Davidoff. Matt is on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
When I heard you reading an excerpt from the book, I was very strongly reminded of Bruno Schultz with the fantastic and the mental illness intersecting in a very sensual depiction of childhood. And I was just wondering if you could, you just spoke about some of the themes that interest you, that have influenced you. I wondered what authors have helped you develop your literary voice.
Matt, thanks. Well,
thank you, Matt. That's an incredibly flattering thing to say. And yes, I'm a great admirer of Bruno Schultz. What books do I love? I love books that many people love. I love the great Russian writers. My grandfather brought me up to love Tolstoy and Turgenev and, you know, Gogol and Chekhov. And I love Boswell's Life of Johnson is one of my favorite books. For this book, as I just said, I thought a lot about sort of coming-of-age novels like Great Expectations and David Copperfield, and My Antonia is one of my favorite books. But I also thought a lot about the great memoirs that have been written. And, you know, the memoirs is sort of a complicated part of literature right now because there are so many people who have abused it. And I took it as my mission, really, to make my book true in sort of a broader, more literary sense, but also factually true. I fact-checked this book as carefully as I fact-checked, you know, my book about Mo Berg or my book about country music. You know, this is as rigorously true as I could make it. And as I wrote it, I also thought about the great memoirs that have been written, ones that I really admire. And I admire many different ones for many different reasons, like, you know, Alfred Kazin's A Walker in the City is a marvelous book. Ian Fraser's Family is just a magnificent book. I'm a great admirer of M.F.K. Fisher, the way she uses writing about the history of food throughout her life to tell the story of her life, really, with food is just the sort of central inflection for stories about family. And I like Freeman Dyson, the great physicist's book, Disturbing the Universe, is a magnificent book. And I would recommend it, especially to people who are afraid of physics, because you don't have to know anything about science to be just completely enraptured by the soul and the spirit that is in that book. I could go on and on.
Before we go to break here, Nicholas Davidoff, tell us about the title of your own book, The Crowd Sounds Happy. Where did that come from?
The title of the book, I wanted something to express, you know, such a central theme of this book is radio and the things that you can do just with sound to sort of make up your life when your life isn't exactly the way you want it to be. And so I was thinking that I sort of wanted that at the center of it, and I wanted something that expressed being far away from something and yet being a part of it too. And I was with a friend of mine, the great graphic novelist Ben Ketcher, and we were sitting in a Russian restaurant in New York City, and we were just talking about this, and we were thinking about how on the radio they used to talk about the happy sounds of the crowd, and we went that way. Eventually we sort of, you know, turned that into The Crowd Sounds Happy. But what I like about the title, or, you know, what suited me about it, is that there is a certain kind of ambivalence. Are you part of things or are you not? The crowd seems to be happy. Are they really happy? There's that. I think most of life is not, you know, sort of firm in its conditions. Most of life is about something that is about to happen, where things are not sure and there are many possibilities. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like so much about baseball, that it's a game that is full of possibilities, just like life.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about growing up in thrall to baseball this hour with our guest Nicholas Davidoff, author of the new memoir, The Crowd Sounds Happy. Let's go to some of our callers now. Susan is up first in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan.
Hey, I wanted to say hey to Nikki. Nikki, it's Sue Bitinsky.
Oh, hi, Sue. Sue was a high school classmate of mine.
Aha.
I... I read the book when it first came out, and I've been meaning to email you, Nikki. I have your email from Annette, and I've just been busy. But when I heard you on the radio, I just had to sneak in a hello and let you know how beautiful the book is and how powerful and how
sad. Thank you. You know, one of the things that is a very difficult thing to do when you're writing about your childhood is to write about adolescence, to write about high school. And as Sue could tell you, I was, among other things, the last kid in my high school class to have his voice change. And I was, you know, I played a lot of sports, but I was always the smallest one. And that put me in sort of, I didn't quite know how to be in those situations. And I was, if you're a little kid and you're in those surroundings and you don't quite know how to be, maybe other bigger kids notice this. And so I tried to write as well and as honestly I could about what it's like to feel, you know, we talk a lot about when boys are in high school and how they're supposed to be strong and, you know, tough and things like that. And I was not strong and I wasn't particularly tough. And I tried to write about what that feels like and how you think about it and so forth. And it's gratifying to know that at least one person I went to high school with thinks maybe I got it right.
Susan, how do you remember Nicholas Davidoff from those years?
Oh, well, I've really, really liked Nikki then, and I still like Nikki now. One thing that I wanted to say, I've never read a memoir by somebody I know. This is the first time, and it was very interesting to see how honest it was, Nikki, how Nikki really captured places I've seen, too, and people I've known, and things I've heard, and things I felt, how he brought all of that to life. I didn't know if memoirs were exaggerated or somewhat fictional, so it was such a delight to read a nonfiction story by somebody I knew and be able to compare my recollections with his.
Thanks for calling in. I appreciate it, Susan. Thanks. It really is a memoir of two cities, isn't it? The crowd sounds happy. Nicholas.
Yes, it is. I mean, I sort of, if you have one parent in New York, as I did, and then you're growing up in New Haven, necessarily, even though I was spending far more time in New Haven, your life shifts back and forth. And it's interesting that those were, the 1970s especially, were not great times for either of those cities. And they seemed to sort of, whatever it was about those cities that was happening to them seemed to draw out whatever was happening in me. There's something about how when you're a child, especially if you grew up in a place like New Haven, which is an incredibly diverse city, it was an industrial city and yet it had Yale, a great university at the center of it. It was a real city, but it also was small enough and the neighborhoods were compressed enough that you could see a little bit of everybody by walking not very far. It's a pretty diverse place. And one of the things that I tried to write about is the way a child responds to landscape. And the way when I'm very small, you know, the sidewalk in front of my house is like the Grand Canyon. It's the whole world, you know, and this is my territory. And as I get older, the sidewalk seems to lead further and further all over. And the city seems to open up as you open up. In a place like New Haven, you could imagine that it was responding to you. But one of the things that happened to New Haven through my childhood is that it became more and more depressed as a city. You know, it was sort of one of these great sort of bastions of urban renewal, but it really didn't work, and it was full of all these ugly buildings, and it was full of, you know, these ugly concrete sort of brutalist experiments, and it was full of crime and drugs and urban decay, and it became, you know, I mean, there's a big New Yorker piece at a certain point which talked about it as sort of a crack capital of America. But it was my home, and I really wanted to defend it, and I loved it, and I loved growing up there. And when I went to college, I went to Harvard, you know, there were lots of people there who made fun of New Haven and said they never would have applied to Yale because New Haven was such a pit. And I wrote this passionate piece in the newspaper talking about what a great city New Haven was. And I still feel that way. I still feel it's a city filled with such character, and I feel very lucky to have grown up there.
Read a short clip from the book about New Haven.
Sure. My harbor city, beloved city of my youth, city of faith founded by ministers, city of industry where a mass-produced firearm was invented and also the lollipop, model city of the war on poverty, learned city of light and truth, now somnolent, desiccated, city fled by whites, abandoned by governments, riven with the hardship and its pyrrhic consolations, the public common a penumbra, the sidewalks empty at eventide, panic grass between the cracks, miles of neglected porches, all the vacant lots, fleets of tumble-down cars modeled in body shop maroon, the acid-green river feeding the oil-soaked current, currents, heaps of scrap at the northern delimits, hills of slag to the south, a property without value, my city in ruin.
Let's go back to the phones at this point to welcome Allison from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment to a point that was made earlier. As someone who suffers from pretty severe mental illness, I just wanted to say thank you for the point that you made about it being something that is pretty devastating, but at the same time, it's not seen by people on the outside, and there is all this aberrant behavior and this just kind of weird things that you do when you're mentally ill, and it's so hard going in and out of hospitals and having people just think that you're this crazy person trying to hold on to hope is really tough. But I just really wanted to say thank you for making the point of it being something that is pretty serious and at the same time largely unseen.
Allison, thank you. I appreciate
your
call.
Thanks, Allison. I'm so sorry that this happened to you.
You know, you write in your book, Nicholas Davidoff, that when you have a parent who struggles with mental illness, who is troubled, it's easy to assume that you wonder if you might have the same struggles. Did you?
Oh, definitely. I spent a great deal of my childhood and crucially, my adolescence. Many kids want to sort of blend in. But when I was trying to blend in, one of the things I was trying to do is, this is sort of a complicated thing, as best I can express it, I was trying to conform and be like other kids so that other kids would in fact tell me somehow that I was normal and that I wasn't going to turn out like my dad, that I was just healthy and like them. And so I was one of the worst conformists at certain ages that you ever saw. I wanted to wear the clothes that other kids wore, but I wanted to wear them with a purpose, and I wanted to speak the way other kids spoke, and I wanted to not be made fun of, and I wanted to be just a kid like every other kid, not only because it was comfortable and the path of least resistance, but also because it was the path of confirmation that I wasn't going to, end up talking to animals in the backyard or strapped to a bed or something.
Back to the phones now. Ted is in Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, Ted. Welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. I'll make my point quickly here, and really what I wanted to say is really a message to all the dads out there. I grew up a Yankee fan in upstate New York, and my father wasn't interested in baseball particularly, but he knew I was. And my favorite memory of my dad was him walking up to me one day and say, how would you like to go to the World Series? Mm-hmm. You can imagine what that did to a young 13-year-old baseball fan. Mm-hmm. We drove half the night to get there and went to this wonderful game the next day. And David, it was Ted Williams that threw out the first ball at that game. It was the year he retired in 1960. And I just wanted to say, for someone who did have a father and did have an interest in his son growing up, that game in my memory has faded over the years. I still remember some of the specificity of it, but the big thing was, and what the enduring memory of in my mind, is sitting next to him and looking at him, looking at me enjoying the game. So it's almost like I've gone through the looking glass over all these many, many years. In 1960 at age 13, it was the game, mm-hmm. but now it's the fact that my dad took me there. Mm-hmm. So I've always said that baseball is a game that you should be introduced to as a kid by your dad or a close family member, mm-hmm. not a parole officer or some stranger. Mm-hmm.
Ted, thanks. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Nick, Ted. I was introduced, as I said, by my Aunt Susie, and for a lot of my childhood, that really bugged me. It seemed like the right thing hadn't happened, that you were supposed to play catch with your dad, you were supposed to learn about baseball from your dad. But I think that it's wonderful for all the people who learn about baseball from their dads. And, there's a reason that's sort of a great American archetype, fathers playing catch with sons and so forth. But I guess one of the things that isn't talked about when these sort of tropes are introduced in life is that so many people don't have that. And it seems initially a terrible thing if you don't have it. And I guess one of the things that I think just about my own childhood is that one of the great things about life, being an American, whatever, is that there, aside from the sort of more conventional paths, there's so many ways to go through life and to have things introduced to you and to be loved and so forth. And I guess I just feel very fortunate. It seems appropriate to me that my very sensual aunt was the first person who showed me baseball and that it was my grandfather who taught me so much more about it. I guess the other thing I want to say really, really quickly is that one thing I thought a lot about as I wrote this book was the sort of stereotype of the American man who sits on the couch and cries when his baseball team, you know, loses at the end and doesn't win the big game, and his wife who doesn't understand – this is, again, stereotypical – but yeah, his wife who can't understand at all why he would cry about that, and yet he can't talk to her about the death of his father or their own failing marriage or whatever it is. And I guess I have to say that a lot of American men really are brought up not to be emotional in so many different ways, and that for whatever reason, because of stories like Ted – these are the things that people are – it is acceptable to be emotional about. So I don't think that that's necessarily a good thing. I think that you should be able to talk to your wife. But I do think that it is a – if you understand it a little more, that this – the sort of – it's not just a game. It sort of represents relationships in childhood where it's sort of almost permissible to be emotional in ways that maybe for lots of men it isn't acceptable in other places. That's why that happens.
Mm. Ted's call reminds me of your story of going to Cooperstown with your mom instead of your dad.
Yeah, one of the things about my mother is that she really didn't, you know, she's somebody who didn't have a lot of money, but she had tremendous desire to be giving and to be generous. And one of the ways that she was generous, I mean, the way generosity works is, of course, giving things that somebody else wants, not the things that you want for them. And when I was, I think I must have been about 10 years old, when I wanted more than anything was to go to the Baseball Hall of Fame. And so she drove from New Haven all the way to New Hampshire to leave my sister at my grandparents. And then she drove me all the way to Cooperstown. And we went to Cooperstown. And this was my chance to see what, you know, it was like the Golden City, you know, it was El Dorado. And I remember driving through the Green Mountains and coming through the sort of farmland of New York and arriving there. And it was so exciting. But then as the day progressed, I began to notice that I was the only boy that was there with his mother and that every other little boy I seemed to see was there with his dad. And I just became incredibly upset. And I remember just the tremendous feelings of guilt coupled with the tremendous feelings of resentment because, you know, I didn't want to make my mom feel bad. She was doing this incredibly generous and benevolent thing. She was taking me to Cooperstown and she was taking me to restaurants, which we never did because we didn't have money for it and so forth. It was just a great thing. And I got to be in the Baseball Hall of Fame and see, you know, Christy Mathewson's glove and Babe Ruth's spikes and Ty Cobb's bat or whatever. You know, but I just as the time went on, I couldn't get over the fact that there were all these dads around and I wasn't normal. I wasn't there with my dad. It wasn't the way it was supposed to be. And I just remember I was horrible to my mother. And, you know, that's what is it? That's childhood, right?
Do I remember correctly? It was your mom who took you to your first game at Fenway as well.
Yeah. Yeah, she did. Yeah. And that was, of course, everybody's first game at Fenway Park, but just because it's such a beautiful and interesting place, is probably at least intriguing for them. I mean, baseball stadiums that are – I mean, one of the things that's so great about Fenway Park is that it's a stadium which is built into the fabric of a city that is – you know, you can see the city as it existed then. So many of the weird angles and the strange sort of geometric possibilities of the place have to do with the way that, you know, that Boston was, configured at that time. And I just loved that. I was sitting in a place that didn't look like any other place. And it felt to me kind of like the Great Palace. This was, and I would look around and, you know, everything there just seemed it seemed beautiful and interesting and exciting. And, you could look out beyond the walls and see the city and so forth. And then I just felt filled with promise when I was there. It was a very, very romantic experience. And I remember thinking to myself then that I had never felt happier in a place than when I did in that baseball field. You were sitting there surrounded by walls. It was safe. There were the people who I listened to on the radio night after night, finally in the flesh. And my mom was there, who was always so great to me. And it was just, it was an unimaginably good time. And of course, they lost 12-1.
Mm-hmm. I just go back to this point about the fact of going through struggles in your life. It's really the great theme of your book, is it not?
Well, I think my mother would say, and I would say too, that all the best stories are not stories of just pure happy endings, but they are stories of struggle and overcoming adversity. I mean, this is everybody's life. No matter how good anybody's life looks, it's full of, you know, sort of daily struggle, daily turmoil, overcoming things. And for me anyway, those are the stories. I mean, so I like the Russians so much. Maybe it's because, you know, my ancestors, many of them were Russian, you know, but I'm just very attracted to not the easy path, but what people do when they're sort of confronted with conflict, when they're confronted with difficulty or a sort of a series of choices, none of which look completely appealing. To me, it's so much more. It's another reason to like baseball, that it exists for a long time, and even the best teams lose a lot. I think everybody in life loses a lot, and life is more about what you do with loss rather than just trying to avoid it.
I have about 30 seconds left, Nicholas Davidoff, and I'm just curious, given everything that we've heard from you this hour, if you watch or listen to baseball in a different way now.
I think it's unavoidable that as you go through life, that the central passions of your life are going to adapt with you through life. And so, sure, as an adult, one of the things that's harder to do is to ignore all the unseemly things that are there in professional sports. You know, we can talk about steroids, we can talk about greed, so many of those things. But also one of the great things about being adult is the ability to sort of straddle things that were part of your past. That sort of baseball is something that take you back into childhood emotions, much like rereading books. And for me, rereading my Antonia is a lot like listening to the Red Sox.
What a pleasure to have you with us this hour and to read your book, Nicholas Davidoff. The book is called The Crowd Sounds Happy, the sound of love, madness, and baseball. Thanks for being with us today.
Jane, thanks so much for having me.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast. Read an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.